MRIs, and a host of other different techniques. The work that Bruce does is remarkable, and we are so fortunate to have him here for lots of different reasons. But I think particularly for you and your colleagues, it's an interesting way to break the frame in which you may typically view education and human development. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to you and welcome Professor McCandless. Bruce.
Well, hi, everybody. I'm hoping that during this hour we can touch upon a whole bunch of different little topics, and each one is going to be kind of a new entry point into this central question that I want everybody to think about for just a couple of minutes. Our generation is really special for lots of reasons, but we happen to be born in a period of history that's completely unprecedented, where we can now look at the most complex entity in the entire universe, which is a human mind, a human brain. It's more complex on any metric of complexity that physicists have ever developed in terms of how well connected it is, and most importantly, the most intriguing thing that anybody has ever really posed is, how is it that matter can give rise to consciousness, can give rise to the human spirit, the human intellect? And what I want to challenge you guys all to think about, and we're going to take a couple minutes on this, and you're going to break into pairs of three and discuss this and then shout out answers that came up. What is this incredible ability that we have to now look at the human brain, how the human brain develops, how changes in ideas can be linked to these little connections between neurons and electrical pulses or regions of the brain that might be critical for, as you see in the popular media, regions that critically involve what you care about, what you're driven to, or regions of the brain that reorganize as you start to get insight into a particular domain? What is the potential that we have as a generation to link these insights about the human brain, or all the different human brains, to education in general? So this is a general, open-ended question. I want it to be open-ended because I'm really interested in what you guys might think and come up with. You're going to break up into pairs of roughly three. We're going to discuss it for a couple of minutes. I'll be coming around. But I just want to engage your intuitions, and then I'm going to give you what answers I've come up with trying to do this for the last 10 years and tell you how far we are and where the limitations are, but also what the hope is in terms of doing this. So think about this. As we get every single year more and more insights into how the human brain is working, how it's developing, how it gives rise to the mind, how individual brains differ, how we can now image regions of the brain that are associated with things like curiosity, or attentiveness, or engagement, or changes in the brain that occur that allow somebody to engage in mathematics or reading or what, however you want to construe the problem. But let's, right now, break into groups of threes and talk about this problem, and then we'll do kind of a shout-out towards the end. So let's just take 3 or 4 minutes to do this. You probably know the people that you're sitting next to. People tend to self-organize into these groups, small world phenomenon. But go ahead. Have at it. We've got 3 minutes. Thank you.
so glad they got you hooked up. Who knew there was a drawer of cables right here?
I know.
Right here.
Really well hidden.
In plain sight. Well,
I think the recorder is going.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Okay, pencils down. So, who wants to give, just kind of blurt out a couple of phrases of things that came up, concepts, domains, ideas, full sentences?
EMDR.
EMDR, very interesting. Okay. People might ask, what is that? Shout out a bunch of other things, and we'll dig into a couple of them. Okay. Other domains, topics, ideas? Where did you guys go with this? What kind of behavioral issues? Okay.
Studying the brains of highly successful problem-solving 3 to 5 year olds, seeing that we could start to do things with other 3 to 5 that were successful with us.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Other ideas that popped up? This is what happens when you put an iPhone next to a Mac. Okay. Anyone last chime in? I think these are all great suggestions and domains that are currently under investigation. I don't know if we've cashed out any of them in terms of things that would actually lead to recommendations next month or next year about exactly what we do. But I think that these are all viable questions that we really could dig into using brain imaging and trying to formulate questions within education, the burning needs that educators face in terms of how do you get a kid really engaged in a topic, or how do you help them with a stumbling block that they have in learning, or how do you approach children of different ages or different abilities or different backgrounds, and how can you, as a teacher, have the greatest ameliorative effect, how can you have the greatest modeling effect, how can you inspire and engage. I think all of these things are fair game for connecting brain imaging together with our understanding of how mental processes work and make a fundamental connection between the mind, which is fundamentally a mentalistic construct, and the brain, which is fundamentally a physical construct. And as Jim Hoag said, maybe there's a way to bring together studies of the physical and studies of the mental in really profound new ways that really get some traction. I'm going to tell you about 4 different lines of research that I'm involved in to try to address this really difficult connection between observations that are made at the level of brain science and questions and issues and insights that come from education, to try to bring these two together, because that's what I'm going to try to do with the rest of my career, is to try to make a fundamental connection between these 2 very different types of research and inquiry. And the place I'm going to start is with focusing on reading. Reading is a really great place to start here because we know a lot about it from cognitive psychology and from neuroscience. We also know a lot about it from the education side, and it happens to be something which is introduced pretty late in life, and it's actually been introduced pretty late in history. So human beings were around a lot longer than the writing system. It's not a natural thing for us to, just as humans, to read and write. This is something that was had a punctate invention about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, and has been transmitted from culture, from one generation to the next, through education. And that's the only reason why it exists, but I think it's transformed humanity from one stage of society to another. And it's transformed the human mind. Literacy really changes the human brain in fundamental ways that we can now measure. But I'm going to talk about four different levels of research that try to dig into this question. And I won't really get to go very far into each one, but I'll get to give you a flavor of the approach. And the first level approach that, when I was a graduate student, was all the rage and it was the limit of the field, really, was what I want to call functional organization in expert adults, where you take the end state of somebody who's fully literate and knows how to read really, really well, and you study the heck out of them in every way that you can. You probe them, you say, how many milliseconds does it take you to read this word out loud? And you build cognitive models, and you can relate these models of how information is processed in the functional system to observables about the human brain. And this is a pretty amazing endeavor because you can start to look at a living human brain and say, what areas of that brain are active when a person's thinking about the sounds of the word versus thinking about the meaning of the word versus thinking about, is that the font that my mom typically uses in a letter? These different aspects of focusing your attention lead to changes in brain activity in the expert state. But there's limits to this. Reading is fundamentally the end of an entire developmental educational progression. It's the history, it's the achievement of 10, 20 years of schooling and education and learning and thousands of hours of practice. So where some more interesting action is understanding organization of function during development. How is it that the experiences that you had during development led to this expert state, to this ability that we all have of being able to fluently read? What had to change in the mind of a 5-year-old child who had organized their brain through largely through evolutionary bias to hear words and hear language and see the world and see objects? But now that they're turning 6 and going to first grade, suddenly they have to do something very different with their brain. They have to connect analysis of the visual world to analysis of the linguistic world, and they have to connect them really, really well. So within half a second or a quarter of a second of looking at a written word, you know exactly what word in your language, which might be 50,000 words, that corresponds to. You build this, you're rewiring the brain at a systems level. We can now look at that progression because we can look at the developing brain. We can see how our brain's changing through the process of typical development and of typical education. And this is raising profound questions that are right on the edge of our understanding of neuroscience and cognition. How is it that experiences are changing our brains? How is it that changes in our brains related to experiences are changing our ability and what we can do in the next moment? But this is basic science. This is science focused on the abstract question of how does the human brain develop? There are even more interesting questions, I think, and especially that's going to be relevant to, I think, education. And that's shifting the focus not to how does the brain develop, but how do brains develop differently? Every single human brain that we ever study in our studies has tremendous variation to it in all sorts of unimaginable ways. And we can now look at the physiology and the anatomy and correlates of individual differences. We can start to see how a population of children, how their brains differ from one another, and how these differences in the human brain, as played out in every individual child, relates to individual differences in how well they're doing in these abstract intellectual skills like reading, mathematics, reasoning, drive, even attention, focusing their attention on something that they're curious about or driven to learn. We can trace out the brain systems involved in all of these things and see how do people differ. I'm not going to say that this is going to tell us exactly how we approach educational problems, but I'm going to say that it's like opening up just a whole nother treasure box of potential insights that give us more to work with. But then the last one I want to talk about, and this is where my research is really focused and the reason why I came to Vanderbilt, and that's this notion of functional reorganization driven by intervention. So what do I mean by that? I mean using education as the experimental manipulation to see how is it that a learning experience studied in the laboratory or studied in the model classroom or in the field leads to changes in brain activity. So we want to put people in educational situations, have them learn something, and then map that systematically, the changes that we see in the individual brains. And we want to see how the entire group tends to change on average, but even more interestingly, we want to see how do individuals respond differently to these experiences. We know there's a tight tie between experiences and ultimate brain development, brain organization, but the devil is really in the details here, really figuring out this mapping between them. So I'm going to try to touch on all four of these levels, and then we're going to come back to your questions at the end, hopefully if I manage the time, and manage not to mismanage the time. So let me start at the first level, the expert state. This is pretty much where everybody in this room is. Everybody is a visual expert in reading English in this room, I think. And this ability depends on a very particular circuit in the brain that we've been able to map out, we've been able to study. And even more importantly, it's built on, that circuit's built on some circuitry that we all had when we were 4 and 5 years of age. This is a lateral view of the human brain, and we've kind of inflated it using computer graphics in order to look at the entire surface of the human brain. And we're plotting out in blue regions of the brain that are heavily responsive to spoken language. Somebody's just lying in the scanner and you're playing them samples of spoken language. These areas of the brain that are just up and behind your left ear are highly responsive to processing the information in auditory language. These areas in red are highly responsive to processing the information in visual letters. So if you're just looking at the letters of a word, these areas of the brain are highly responsive. I don't know if you can see this cursor. Can you see it when I move it like that? Okay. These areas in the back of the brain, in the visual system, are highly responsive to the letters. These areas in this blue region are highly responsive to auditory words. And this is basically the organization that you have after 36 months of age. There's very clear differentiation of these circuits. But what happens when you go through school and you learn to read is that these circuits learn to talk to each other in a brand new way. There's a plastic reorganization of the entire system driven by education, driven by your experiences, looking at letters and activating language. And we can map out this circuit, and we can see how this massive reorganization takes place as kids go through first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. And even more importantly, we can map out how do individual brains differ in terms of pulling off this big reorganization that education requires of all of us. And as an aside, education didn't really require this of all of us until very recently. It wasn't until the printing press that we're in this bizarre situation where the entire population is expected to learn to read. And when there's a small subset of the population that can't do this very well, they're considered in some sort of pathological range. We're able to look at these individual differences by imaging adults who've had lifelong difficulties in learning to read. These are not difficulties associated with intelligence, associated with the drive to learn, associated with even the desire to learn to read. These are difficulties that are very specific to this one challenge of reorganizing your visual system to interface with your language system. And when we look at, there have been dozens of studies looking at the difference between dyslexic adults and non-dyslexic adults that are roughly equal in intelligence and opportunity and drive. When you average all of these studies together, there's a couple of brain regions that pop out as being really critically involved. One is this region back near the visual system that I call the visual word form area. And another is this region. It's hard to point at all three screens at once, but Can you see this little mouse moving? Okay. This region is in the language cortex, associated with processing the sounds of language. These regions are not as responsive in an fMRI scan when a dyslexic is trying to do a simple word reading task. For controls, for most people in this room who are skilled readers, these regions become really specifically active when we're reading versus when we're doing most anything else you can do with your brain. For dyslexics, these regions are not very responsive, and we're able to start to dig into this individual difference. So, understanding the hallmarks of reading experts, as a result of all the thousands of hours we all spent in this one activity of reading, of picking up human language through looking at these little visual word forms, we've taken on the hallmarks of experts. And these hallmarks exist across multiple forms of expertise. If any of you become experts in radiology, or experts in recognizing cars, or experts in nearly any field that requires intensive visual analysis, you get these hallmarks of expertise where the meaning of the symbol or the meaning of the stimulus becomes readily apparent. In a quarter of a second or a fifth of a second, you're able to know exactly what stimulus you're looking at. The activation of words, their meanings, and their sounds are completely automatic. If I throw up a word on the screen, you can't help but have the sound of that word sort of active in your mind. And third, there's this process that we call configural processing, where you look at a word as an entire unit, and the entire combination of all these letters kind of combine automatically. We can map out the circuitry of the brain to see exactly where the changes occur. So this is a great question, I think, because it's a general question that you can apply to lots of forms of expertise. And it was raised over here looking at 3 to 5 year old problem solvers. How does the rise of expertise lead to changes in the brain? If you become an expert in something, like if you become an expert in recognizing race cars or shoes or some, you spend thousands of hours looking at objects and being able to categorize them very rapidly. There are changes that occur in our visual system so that when we show you the object of your expertise, a part of your visual system becomes selectively activated. You've rewired the response properties of your visual system through your experiences. So we can look at the rise of these expertise effects and see how does reading change the visual system. And we've been able to map that out in skilled adults. We understand the circuitry of it. But once you become an expert, there's two things that really go on. You are skilled, your visual system changes the way information flows up from the world. So if I show you the object of your expertise, your visual system already does kind of an automatic analysis of it and kind of tells you the significance of, wow, that's a 1967 X-type Jag. And you just know that instantly. Your visual system has organized that information for you. But there's another thing that goes on, and this is the part that I think is most critically important for the link between education and neuroscience. And that is, you become much better at attending to certain types of information. And that's one of the things that happens when you learn something. You learn what's really critical to attend to. What's going to give me the juice out of this situation and tell me what's going on? So in addition to these bottom-up changes that occur with expertise, where you've got these well-organized circuits that just sort of automatically process and organize the world for you in really interesting and useful ways, there's this top-down process. And this is the process that's kind of leading the show of becoming an expert at something. There are these top-down processes where you are focusing your attention, not just at the task, but at particular forms of information. And as you focus your mind on this particular form of information, you're leading to changes in your brain. You're leading to changes in your brain activity in the moment, and you're leading to lasting changes in the potential activity in your brain. And so, for reading, what's really critical for an early reader? What type of information is critical for them to attend to that might drive these changes in the brain? This has been the answer of over 2,000 scientific papers and graduate student dissertations and master's theses. And one of the nice things about it is that at this point in history, there seems to be a converging answer coming out across all of these studies as the one sort of winning hypothesis. And that is your ability to focus your mind on the sounds of language is a critical factor in becoming a skilled reader during the early years. The National Research Panel suggests that children who can focus on the sounds of language, phonology, who can do rhyming games and Pig Latin games and play with the sounds within words, those are the children that are able to break the code and be able to decode words and are able to reorganize their brain very easily to becoming expert readers. So we just started doing some new research. This research was just published about 3 weeks ago in the Journal of Cerebral Cortex. And I want you guys to participate in this little experiment that we ran to get at this question of what is it to focus your attention on information, on the sounds of language. And I hope this works. So what I want you guys to do is to close your eyes and then listen to these two sets of sounds. And in the first condition, I want you to listen to the words within these sounds and tell me whether they rhyme or not. Let's first do an audio check and make sure this works.
Bathe.
Okay. So now I'm going to play you a pair of sounds just like that. Tell me whether the words you hear rhyme or don't rhyme. And this is a little bit like detecting bad poetry. So if something kind of rhymes, that's not close enough. Like, these lyrics drive me crazy. Like, yeah, I won't go into that.
Bathe. Crave.
Raise your hand if you think those rhyme. You can open your eyes for this part. Raise them high. Come on, commit to an answer here. Okay, raise your hands if you don't think they rhyme. Okay, now listen really, really carefully. We'll do it again.
Bathe. Crave.
Raise your hand if you think they rhyme. Okay, let's do another one. Listen really carefully.
North. Bathe.
Raise your hand if you think they rhyme. No one's raising their hand. Okay, so now I want you to listen to the same exact bottom-up stimulation for your brain. And you're going to do an equally challenging task and make a decision and all of that stuff. But the only thing we're going to change is the information that you're focusing your mind on. You might have heard buried within those words was a little triplet of, a little melody. I want you to tell me whether the melody matches in the first word and the second word.
Crave. Noise.
Raise your hand if they think they matched. Okay, let's try another one.
Bathe. Crave.
Raise your hand if they think they matched. Okay. What we've found in this research is that the same exact stimulation, the same equally challenging task, people can focus their mind on one kind of information and completely ignore the other. Or they can focus on the tone information and completely ignore the words, and focus on the linguistic information and completely ignore the tones. In a sense, this is the difference between hearing what somebody's saying and listening to what somebody is saying. You can amplify these signals in your mind in this top-down fashion. This skill turns out to be critical in the early years of learning to read because this is exactly the phonological analysis you have to do so that our alphabetic system for writing words makes any sense at all. We've been able to do brain imaging studies on undergraduates and master's students as they do this task. As they listen to the same exact stimuli and make equally difficult decisions, the only thing we're changing is what information are you attending to make your decision? And what we find is that listening to language, really listening to the sounds in language, this critical skill for learning to read, activates specific left hemisphere circuitry. There are these prefrontal regions, which are sort of critical for intentional control of what your mind is doing right now. There are these superior parietal regions, but critically, this region that we call the visual word form system, this region that's most responsive to visual words if you're a reading expert, is also activated even though no word is present at all. This is a reentrant process in which our ability to think about the rhymes is automatically linked to brain organization for reading words. But most importantly, the thing I want to take away from this is that very notion, that elusive notion of attention, of attending to types of information in this top-down, engaged, focused way, may be a critical factor that's driving brain reorganization in skills like learning to read, but this may be a more general principle in systems neuroscience, that this kind of engaged learning or engaged focus and attending is the critical thing which is reshaping circuitry. The reason this could be important for education is that this is what good teachers do. Good teachers are able, they have an amazing talent, and it's not something that can be easily taught, but it can be something that you win over experience. They grab the attention of their students, and they help their students focus their minds in useful ways on the most interesting, informative, informational part of this multidimensional world, of all these complex situations. This is what I'm trying to study. This is one level at which we want to connect education and cognitive neuroscience. We have other ways of measuring the brain, and this is not a lecture on methodologies for imaging the brain, but this one I really like because it does something that you can't really do with just where in the brain this process is active, and that is electrophysiology. There are, at Vanderbilt, about 6 different electrophysiology labs, and this is a very hot area of research. What we're able to do is, in really crude terms, surround the scalp with salty sponges, connect those to wires, and to listen in on fluctuations of brain activity. The nice thing about this is we can do this 1,000 times a second, which allows us to do something which is akin to stop-motion photography. We can look at the brain activity in response to an event. If you average together 1,000 little one-second movies of people's brain activity spontaneously, they all kind of average out to this zero baseline. However, if inside each one of those one-second samples an event occurred at exactly the same time, like a word popped up on the screen, it leads to this ripple effect in the brain activity we call an event-related potential. We can make a movie of this ripple effect that's kind of like if you look at a stop-motion photography of a drop of water hitting a glass of water, the surface, you can look at this beautiful cascade of events that was completely invisible before because it was just too fast. But when a drop of water, about 170 milliseconds after it hits the surface, this echo drop appears, and this penumbra appears. And this drop isn't the drop that you dropped, but this is like an echo drop that was reformed. And you can look at all of these complex dynamics as they unfold over time. You can do the same thing with human electrical signals by plotting out the voltage over the whole head and seeing how does that voltage change when a word hits the retina, and the retina, the information processes to the back of the head, and the visual systems analyze, and they pass the information back forward to the front of the head so you can evaluate what was that I saw. When we do this over the course of 1 second over the back of the head, we get these traces that are very interesting and very complex, and I'm not going to go into that, but critically, who you are and what you've done with your life has a big impact on how these things emerge. So if you're a skilled reader and you recognize these visual words, you get an increased response about 170 milliseconds. After you see a visual word, your visual system responds quite differently to a visual word if you're skilled, if you're an expert in reading, versus if you're looking at some stimulus for which you have no expertise at all. We can map that out over the head just by presenting the object of your expertise, these visual words, or something completely novel. And we can look at how the brain responds differently across these. And we can map this out at a snapshot, right when these two signals diverge, right when the expertise first starts to show itself in the signal, that we can see this deviation related to your experiences of looking at a visual word versus looking at the symbol. About 170 milliseconds, just about the time that drop of water was forming back out of the surface of the water, we can see this specialization occurring in this left part of the visual system has become reorganized to respond differently to the object of your expertise. So your reading experiences is changing your perception in this very particular way, but this was all, everything I've said up to this point was really looking at just taking the clock apart, understanding the expert state and figuring out how the parts work, how quickly they work, how they're organized, and things like that. And I want to shift now to something completely different. to steal a line from Monty Python. Do you guys still know Python?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Glad to hear it. We cannot understand how the mature system works until we understand how it is constructed in development. We can never lose sight of the fact that even though we're studying the most complex thing in the universe, the adult skilled human mind, this is the product of a developmental process, an educational process. And until we understand these processes of development, how the human brain and human mind are changing and evolving through our lifetimes of experiences, and the role of education in this, we won't really understand that expert state. So we really have to understand these processes that construct the adult mind. Even more so, Johnson and Pennington go on to say, we cannot fully understand that process of normal construction without understanding how development can go awry. So until we have a theory which is bold enough and broad enough to incorporate individual differences, and we can understand variation in human brains, not just the brain or the development of the human brain and the stages that typically developing children go through, but until we understand the diversity of human brains, 10 minutes? Okay. We won't really be able to understand this. And this is where the research connects to special education and connects to understanding individual differences. So we can take this now and we can study how do these electrical signals, how does the brain's response to the world as it happens in real time change over the course of development, over the course of learning experiences? And this is research that is going on here now at Vanderbilt University. So we can study how going through first grade changes your responses to these objects of expertise. We can study how third to fifth grade children, where you get this maximal variation in how well children are reading. Kindergartners, they're all reading really poorly. Adults, they're all reading pretty well. But third to fifth graders, you can't imagine a broader range of experiences and diversity here. We can map out these brain responses to what's going on in terms of their general reading skill. We can correlate them beautifully with what's going on their educational tests. We can make a connection between educational testing and testing of brain responses that occur in the fifth of a second. We can also link this to, this was a paradigm change for me, just the last couple of years. Everything I've talked about so far is brain activity. Get this. There's been a long history of people trying to relate the physical, structural aspects of the brain to our mental lives. And this has been a really tortured literature. Like, at first they thought, oh, how big your brain is related to how smart you are. How much your brain weighs is related. Or maybe it's the density of the gyri in the brain that are related to who's going to be a criminal versus who's going to be a good citizen. Or relating individual dimensions of the structure of your brain to individual dimensions of the structure of your intellectual life or your abilities or your efficiencies. And time and time again, this literature has failed to come to any convergence. But the world is changing. And the world's changing right now. There are new technologies for looking at the structure of your brain, of individual brains, and trying to relate those to the structure of the efficiencies of your cognitive systems. Let me repeat that. Individual structural variation in human brains is related now to individual variations in human minds. What you can do with your mind is related in fundamental ways to microstructure of your brain. This is happening at the level of what they call diffusion tensor imaging, in which we look not at what parts of the brain are active, but how is the brain connected? And how are these different pathways, these white matter tract pathways that let one part of the brain talk to another part of the brain, how are they related to how good you are at, let's say, reading? How good you are at holding seven digits in your mind for a minute? How good you are at remembering what I said 20 minutes ago? There's huge individual variation across all of these domains. And each of these domains are related to specific white matter tracts, such that if we take, as we did in this study, 31 kids, and on this axis here we plot their standard scores in terms of reading. How many people are familiar with standard scores in reading? What is standard scores in reading? Yeah. Master's level students at Vanderbilt don't know what standard scores in reading are? Is that true, or are you guys just being shy? Okay, look it up on Wikipedia. It's a really important thing. Standard scores, it's just a way of looking at how kids differ on a standardized reading test. These scores that you do look at in terms of kids' reading tests, you take a reading test and you get a standard score back, are fundamentally related to white matter tract properties that we're able to measure in the left hemisphere. This is something that's been replicated now in 6 different laboratories around the world. It's been replicated in adults, it's been replicated in children, it's been replicated in studies of dyslexic children versus children who are reading at the typical range. It's been replicated in children who are reading at the typical range all the way up into children who are reading at the exceptional range. There's a very strong correlation between brain anatomy, these white matter tracts, and performance on these school skills, on how well children are doing on these standardized tests of reading. This relationship is a brain behavior relationship. It's a relationship between brain and mind, and it's raising really challenging questions for us, kind of chicken and egg type questions. What's really driving this? Is it true that the way the white matter tracts are organized in your brain is putting some kind of limit or bias on what you can do with your mind? How efficient you are at reading? Or is it more the case that what you're doing with your mind over the course of a lifetime is leading to changes in your white matter tracts, reorganizing your brain based on your effortful, engaged, motivated experiences? There might be a case in which both are true simultaneously and they feed off of each other, but this is the kind of work that we're grappling with. And the way we're grappling with it now is by intervention experiments. And that's the last level that I want to talk about. How many fingers do I have left? 5? Okay. The last thing I want to talk about is intervention experiments. We're taking children that are having profound difficulties in learning to read in second and third and fourth grade, and we're giving them different teaching experiences, some that really focus on focusing their minds on the sounds of words and linking them to letters, and others that are focusing on the larger picture of sitting down, finding a book that you're motivated with, working with a tutor who just helps reads it to you or helps you struggle through the words, and looking at how these impact brain activity, how working with a tutor who approaches the problem one way might differ and change different brain circuits than working with a tutor who approaches the problem another way. By randomly assigning students and tutors and curricula, we're able to really differentiate these larger principles about what's driving changes in brain activity. And just to give you a quick sense of what this research looks like, we're able to see, following 20 sessions of tutoring, changes in patterns of brain activity for kids. And the regions that seem to change the most are the very same regions that are underactivated in dyslexic adults. These left hemisphere regions that are really linked to processing the sounds of language, the same regions that all of you activated when you were focusing your mind on whether bays and crays rhyme or not, versus focusing your mind on the tones within those words. When you focus on the phonology of language, these areas become really active in skilled readers and not very active in dyslexics. If you spend 20 sessions with a tutor who's helping you use your mind this way, when you're in a brain scan at the end of that 20 sessions, these areas become more active when you're reading. And so we're able to make a connection between different types of education and different types of brain reorganization. And I don't want you to focus on that particular study. I mean, it's a couple years old now, and it's not quite as exciting as it used to be, but I want you to focus on that general idea that our generation, we all own this. We all have access to this. This is not some bizarre little subset of scientists that won't talk to anybody else, but this is something that we all have access to. We're able to pose questions about how is the brain changing through these experiences? What are the hallmarks of an amazing educational experience that has the impact of changing minds and also changing brains. That's something that we all have access to and that we all share and that we can all ask throughout our careers, either by becoming brain scientists, maybe you want to do that, maybe you don't, but becoming intelligent consumers of this new form of knowledge which is being transformed about every 2.5 years. It's a completely different game in terms of what we're able to look at, what we're able to measure. This is going to change over the course of our lifetimes in profound ways that nobody can predict. The next 20 years, if they've changed as rapidly as the last 5 years, are going to be really amazing. And we're going to be grappling with questions about how do brains differ? How do minds differ? How do experiences differ? If you spend 5 years going to the wrong college, what did that do to your potential development as an intellectual? I don't know. But these are broad questions that we can all kind of think about. So I want to take the last 3 minutes and have you reconvene in your groups of three and come back at your question again and see if, with these kind of focusing things about what we've learned so far, what questions do you think are possible? What questions would you be interested in if an article came? Would you be even interested in reading? Or would you be just fascinated like that? Wow, that would change everything. The basic question, how does the brain relate to education? You probably all thought I was going to ask you to tell me what you came up with, but that was just a big psych out. This is all for you to just digest.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you all. We'll see you on the 12th. Help me thank Professor McCandless. So trivia tonight at 7:30. Grab a cup of coffee, and we'll see you on November 12th at 3 o'clock for David Dickinson.
What is that? What is that?